Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 28th of August. A lot of questions this hour. Who are the fighters for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria? Why is there an ISIS? How much territory have they seized? Why have they been so successful? Why didn't we see this coming? Are the current round of airstrikes significantly slowing the march of ISIS extremists in Iraq? And what about Syria? How would strikes be done there without benefiting Syria's dictator Bashar al-Assad? What would our ultimate goal be? What are the reconnaissance missions over Syria telling us about the ISIS organization? This hour of the program, Ray Suarez will be joining us. Ray Suarez, of course, is an American broadcast journalist who's been at it for some time. He's the host of Inside Story on Al Jazeera America. Ray was with the PBS NewsHour from 1999 to 2013, most recently as its chief national correspondent. He also hosted NPR's Talk of the Nation for 6 years before joining PBS, and he has worked in other places as well. He has done many shows on what we're going to be talking about this hour with some top-notch experts, so we value his expertise. Inside Story, which Ray Suarez hosts, airs weekdays at 4 p.m. Central Time on Al Jazeera America, cable news channel that covers domestic and international news. In our listening area, Al Jazeera can be seen on AT&T UVerse Channel 1219, DirecTV Channel 347, and Dish Channel 215. We'll be welcoming phone calls about this important issue. Here's how you reach us, as always, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, Ray. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. I guess my first question, and I keep asking this and haven't yet received a satisfactory answer, why didn't we see all of this coming? We have spent so much money on intelligence, on counterterrorism. Why didn't we know about ISIS?
Well, I think ISIS is the product of several unpredictable things on the battlefield, and it was always a possibility. I'll grant that, certainly. And I think it was just considered unlikely. You have to remember, ISIS is now operationally behaving in a way that even Al-Qaeda thinks is a little too out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not something that American policymakers had anticipated. They could not have predicted that Nouri al-Maliki, who was backed by many Americans and was elected by American-sponsored polls, would be so alienating to the Sunnis of Iraq that they would, in effect, detach themselves from Baghdad and become free agents, that ISIS would come roaring out of Syria, no longer have just one battlefront, and make war on Western Iraq. They couldn't have anticipated, I don't think, I mean, maybe it's easy now for people in Washington to look over their shoulders and say, we should have seen this coming. But I think there were a lot of possibilities that had to mesh together in just the right way for this to happen.
Ray, who are these fighters for the Islamic State? Who are these people? Are they, many of them, foreigners? Where did they come from?
Well, from the people that they've bested on the battlefield, arrested, surrounded, whose towns they've occupied, there seems to be a lot of different elements in there. Syrians and Iraqis, Sunnis both, Chechens in some number, disaffected dropouts from active al-Qaeda forces that were part of the militias during the war in Iraq. There's whenever there's a state that ceases to exist in any real functioning way, there's this pool of young men who are now battle-hardened from years and years of near nonstop combat who can move around the world. And there's a lot of money sloshing around, and they get some of these funds, they get the weapons, and they head to where the trouble is. So it's a multinational force, largely Syrian and Iraqi, and Sunni, of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, they appear to be very accomplished fighters, or I guess another way you could look at it is the people they are fighting are incompetent.
Both. I mean, they are getting better because the longer you fight, the better you get. But also with every success, certainly in seizing places like the major cities in western Iraq that they've seized, they get more powerful because they get money, access to oil, and money helps you buy more freelance soldiers and better equipment for them to fight with. Also, people who have been fighting with, let's say, less extreme, irregular fighting forces in places like Syria see the battle going ISIS's way and change sides.
Mm.
Not necessarily change their stripes. They're still against Assad. They're still against any Shia ascendancy in that part of the world. So they just fight under the ISIS flag instead of any of the number of other forces that are in the field in Syria.
And is there a well-defined goal?
Well, they say, I mean, you can only go by what they say, is to reestablish an Islamic caliphate in that part of the world under al-Baghdadi, their leader, who has proclaimed himself the caliph, a religious and political leader of this new entity in the eastern Mediterranean.
We have evidently started reconnaissance missions this week over Syria, trying to gather some information about the ISIS organization. Do you know what those missions hope to accomplish, and do we have very much information about the ISIS organization?
Well, here's where it gets really complicated. The head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey, said we have to stop looking at Syria and Iraq as two separate countries because the borders, in a lot of fundamental ways, have ceased to exist in that part of the world. This is one battle on one front versus one enemy. So how do you carry out surveillance of ISIS in the field, create intelligence about where it is, what it's got, where it's heading, without also, possibly down the road, aiding the very government you're trying to destabilize and overthrow in that region, that of Bashar al-Assad? Does the United States want to become Assad's air force? Certainly not. But as General Dempsey cautioned in his recent testimony before Congress, it gets damn difficult to figure out how to defeat ISIS in one place where you'd be helping Assad and defeat ISIS in the other place where you'd be helping the government in Baghdad, which, after all, it was the center of American policy to establish so that the United States could withdraw from Iraq after 8 years of war there. So, boy, it's a tough one.
Yeah, it's a mess. The president of the Syrian National Coalition, I think this was in the New York Times, was quoted as saying, nobody has talked to us about carrying out airstrikes in Syria up to this moment. If I were in their place, I would talk to us because we're on the ground and we're in a better position to tell them where the ISIS forces are. Really? Nobody's talked to these other more, quote, moderate forces in Syria?
I doubt that's true. Certainly their political leadership, which meets fitfully, periodically, and with varying levels of effectiveness in Istanbul, has given policymakers outside the region fits, because it's hard to know from one week to the next who's in charge, where the money goes, where the military hardware goes, if you give it to them, and how they would deploy themselves in the field. The United States has been, and many other countries, have been almost allergic to aiding these Syrian rebel groups because they are in such proximity to fighters that come from less savory portions of the anti-Assad struggle. And they don't know, and they can't say for sure, whether aiding one ends up aiding them all.
Mm-hmm.
Guests that I had on my program earlier in the week One of them, Shadi Hamid from the Brookings Institution, called not aiding the Syrian rebels when it would have made a difference 2 years ago the original sin of the Obama administration, which only allowed the radicals to gain ground in all the intervening time. And he says, you can't undo the damage. You have to manage the situation as it is. Syria is destroyed. Iraq may cease to be a state. So you have to decide, do you contain ISIS or do you try to defeat them on the battlefield? Not a really very desirable menu right. of choices for the United States.
And would he go on to say that it was pretty clear a couple of years ago who the good guys were among the Syrian rebels?
He says yes. A lot of other people say no.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't altogether clear how effective the leadership was, whether material that was delivered would end up in the right hands, whether money would be and end up funding enemies of the United States. I think it was less clear than people who have been advocating intervention on the side of the rebels have been saying all along.
What is the Obama administration considering now, and what do you see as their time frame? Whose advice are they seeking when it comes to possible airstrikes against ISIS in Syria? What are the pros and cons they're listening to? Who are they listening to? When might they make a decision? Would it be soon?
I think it's going to be soon because we're going to see more significant civilian death on the ground in both Syria and Western Iraq in the coming weeks. This is a humanitarian disaster that's becoming a political and military disaster. As one of my guests called it on a previous show, a moral outrage, which may be enough to pull American public opinion back onto the side of intervention in a part of the world that we've heartily wanted to get out of for a long time. The choices, well, they're not really that easy. When ISIS is put under pressure in Iraq, it simply melts back into its Syrian home base. ISIS is much better funded than it was before because it was able to seize the assets of big banks in cities that it's taken over, seize stockpiles of weapons from the new Iraqi army, the post-Ba'athist army. And, you know, as I said, and as you mentioned earlier, getting better on the battlefield as they fight more and more sophisticated forces. For a long time, the forces of the Kurds, the Peshmerga, were reputed to be the most effective fighting force in the whole region. And ISIS, you know, they've taken some bloody noses from the Peshmerga, but they've also defeated them in several actions on the borders of the Kurdish autonomous region. So they are not the kind of fighting force that that simply collapses. They learn, they adapt, and they stay on the offensive. So it's not going to be that easy for the United States to do this without actually landing people on the ground in these countries, which has been totally anathema to American policymakers. But trying to do it all from the air is something that will only have, according to the experts we've been talking to, medium possibilities of success.
And what about response from other Middle Eastern countries? There must be a number of people and leaders in some of those countries, please name them if you would agree, who are extremely concerned about the rise of ISIS.
Extremely concerned, certainly. I mean, Jordan, one of the most stable and Western-leaning governments in the whole Arab-speaking world, is very worried about what's happened with the Syrian civil war and the expanding range of ISIS. But at the same time, you've also got splits inside the Arab world, splits in the Muslim world over who's winning, who's ahead, who's behind, and how to intervene in a way that makes sense. Qatar is a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood and Muslim Brotherhood-aligned organizations throughout the region. The Saudis have thrown in their lot on the side of stability. So they oppose the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, even though it's an avowedly Islamist political party and certainly one that would advance Saudi interests in creating a more confessional state, a religious state. Yet they just are they are against instability in the Arab world wherever they see it. So Qatar and Saudi Arabia are looking daggers at each other from the Arabian Peninsula. Money is sloshing through the area. The United Arab Emirates have thrown in their lot with Egypt in attacking Libya. So there are fires all across this area that create strange alliances and strange enemies, temporarily perhaps, but I think this may last into the coming era.
We are going to welcome phone calls for Ray as the United States contemplates airstrikes in Syria to hit ISIS targets. What do you think is the wisdom of such a course? What makes sense in trying to counter this terribly violent organization that seems to be pretty effective in what they're doing? What questions do you want to have answered? How can it be contained? Is it our responsibility to contain what's going on, and how would we do that? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. We have lines open for you right now, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Ray Suarez is our guest this hour. He's the host of Inside Story, which airs weekdays at 4 o'clock Central Time on Al Jazeera America. Ray, of course, no stranger to public broadcasting. He was with PBS NewsHour for a number of years and also hosted NPR's Talk of the Nation before joining PBS. We'll be with you in just one moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ray Suarez is our guest this hour. We are talking about ISIS and how we respond to ISIS, a number of important considerations on being discussed, and so much confusion about what ISIS is and how we could accomplish whatever our mission might be. So we're welcoming phone calls. Rich in Rhinelander is our first caller. Hi, Rich.
Hello, Kathleen. Hello, Mr. Suarez. I guess this is what you might call a belly-aching call. There's this saying, better the devil you know than the devil you don't know. Mm-hmm. And we were promised by a previous administration that we would be welcomed into the Middle East if we went to war in Iraq. It seems to me, putting aside humanitarian or ethical considerations, whether Saddam Hussein was worse than ISIS or whatever else, from a national security standpoint, this is an even less stable and less predictable situation for the interests of the United States of America, with the possibility of spending even more money in the Middle East. And I'll stop talking there and simply listen
Can I ask you a question, Rich?
Response to that, whether I
think you make an interesting point.
Really being negative.
But I'd love to hear whether you think the United States has an implied obligation to help set Iraq back on its feet, since much of this instability was created by the American invasion and its aftermath.
Rich, did you hear that?
Well, I did. There is also the saying, you broke it, you bought it. But
yeah, I'm just curious, because right now there's a ambiguity in the American response. When public opinion researchers in the last few weeks have been asking about Syria, about ISIS, about getting re-involved in Iraq, there's this ambivalence in the responses that say, yes, I think what's happening there is terrible, and no, I don't want to get back in there, but yes, somebody has to do something. So it's a little bit all over the map.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it also, thanks, Rich, very much for the call. The question, of course, that we always ask in America is, what is the danger to us? And Chuck Hagel, I believe it was Chuck Hagel, said that he thought that ISIS could prove some kind of a threat to the United States. That always rallies Americans if we consider ourselves a threat. Do you think we are?
Well, certainly ISIS shows every indication of being in many ways more dangerous than Al-Qaeda, because it is an effective force on the field. It's capturing and holding territory. It's tremendously well-financed and willing to do things, it seems, as we watch the destruction of the Christian community in Mosul, the threat of the slaughter of the minority Yazidis in northern and western Iraq. They're willing to do things that that in some ways make Al-Qaeda look like pikers. So I don't know how you expand that threat to include a direct threat to the United States territory. Perhaps our citizens and our assets abroad more likely than the United States directly. But also, I guess you also have to ask yourself whether a place like this, run along the lines that ISIS promises to run it, just by its very destabilizing nature and who the neighbors of the Islamic State are, whether such a place would be, just by its very nature, dangerous to the United States because it's so destabilizing to a flashpoint of the globe.
Mm-hmm. Sarah in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I joined late, so I don't know if you touched on this, but I would just like him to talk about the weapons that they're using being the leftover weapons from our U.S. weapons when we left Iraq. And I'll listen to that off the air.
All right, Sarah, thanks.
Well, actually, they've got things that you can buy on the world market because they are so well-financed. They've got things that they seized from the Syrian military, which has been more Russian-aligned over the past decades, and things that they've seized from the Iraqi military, which in the more recent years has been American-equipped. So they've got a lot of different things going on, and they're able to put more formidable weapons on the battlefield now than a lot of so-called ragtag guerrilla armies have in the past. When they roll into a town, they've got some pretty serious armor and some pretty serious weapons.
Let's go to Kesser next in Germantown. Hi. Hello, are you there? Ray in Rhinelander. Hi.
Yes, Rhinelander seems to be calling in today.
Yes, they are.
Anyways, my concern is the original history part of the Kurds. Now, they are indigenous to a lot of those regions, and if you check the history, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is they've been displaced, especially through within Turkey and adjoining regions, and there were reasons for that. Two, now they're willing to do even more to help with these situations. Why didn't we help to bring them together and train them and get them going in this a long time ago? Also, could you dissect and explain more about the monetary part of ISIS? I mean, you covered the fringe of it, but come on, there's got to be something more to this money, and it's always about the money. So I'll take the comment off
here.
All right,
Ray,
thanks.
Thank
you very much for talking about this.
Thank you. Ray.
Well, our caller from Rhinelander is right. I mean, it's they have money that comes from selling oil that they're seizing in depots in western Iraq out onto the world market. But they've also got money that comes from very rich people in the Persian Gulf, in other places in the world. Governments are recoiling from directly aiding ISIS. But that doesn't mean that rich nationals of these same governments are as reluctant. So ISIS is getting money from a variety of places. But because it doesn't have state sponsors in the same way, it's harder to control than Hamas or Hezbollah or similar kinds of groups that have state sponsors that also pull back that money when things go badly or when that link is doing the state sponsor some damage on the world stage. The Kurds, If you drew a map of where they are, they're a sort of transnational people, as the caller mentioned, large numbers in Turkey, large numbers in Iraq, but also in Syria as well. And, you know, it was understood from the very beginning when the lines of the modern Middle East were drawn upon the collapse of the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War, that the Kurds were the biggest people who were not getting their own country. Winston Churchill realized when the Sykes-Picot Agreement was being hammered out that the Kurds were getting screwed and said so, not necessarily to make a Kurdistan, but just as an observation. And in some ways, the instability of the Iraqi state has been a boon to the Kurds because they've been able to solidify their autonomy, solidify their sovereignty, solidify their grasp on their part of Iraq. The possibilities, according to guests that I've interviewed on the program in recent weeks, the possibilities of Kurdish independence have grown. So you'll see them vying for greater autonomy in the future. But also they are, as the caller suggested, an asset to be used in bringing stability to the region because they have an effective fighting force, an effective government, and are a stable force in an otherwise largely unstable region.
Ray, I'm trying to imagine the president maybe a couple weeks from now coming on national television, as he did a little while ago when he discussed airstrikes against ISIS in Syria, which seemed to be having some kind of effect. I can't quite imagine how he would frame all of this to get the American people to say, yes, this is a good idea, when you're fighting the ruler of Syria, Al-Assad, and you're trying to get rid of ISIS at the same time. I mean, how do you define what a mission is in order to get the American public behind you?
I've asked that very question. And people on Inside Story have said that the mission has to be defined, limited, very clearly explained to the people in its scope and its goals, and that the president has to get over his own doubts about whether American power can be brought to bear in a crisis like this one to good effect. Just the other day, one guest on the program said that it seems that deep down, President Obama doesn't believe that American power can bring about a good end in a situation like this. And, you know, that's certainly not out of the realm of possibility. There are very few good choices on America's menu right now. And I think one thing that people are forgetting about as they wonder what the president is going to do is the very persistent willingness of Congress to oppose the president whatever he does. John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, the Republican leader of the House of Representatives, is already signaling that if the president acts on his own authority and gets involved in pushing back ISIS, there'll be opposition from Congress. Right now, we're in a time of testing of executive authority, as members of Congress wonder aloud about the president being able to use military force abroad without congressional authorization. So, you know, I think this is a pretty as complicated as the situation is on the ground and as resistant to an easy solution, I think there are further political considerations that make moving in one direction or another very difficult for the mm-hmm. president.
Jack in St. Louis. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to point out that it was Bush had a big role in getting Maliki. I mean, technically he was elected, but really Bush is Bush's guy. And I think not only did he divide the country there, but in particular his choice of generals and his getting rid of good generals is what made the seizure of Mosul such a surprise. I mean, I think with better generals, he had Sunni generals in there. It was reminiscent of Stalin, you know, getting rid of his good generals right before World War II. So Maliki is deeply to blame here.
Jack, that's certainly the belief in American policymaking circles, that because Maliki favored the Shias so heavily and alienated the Sunnis whose support he needed to effectively run the country. This was only made worse, gave rise to ISIS power inside Iraq, and really left Maliki unable to respond to the situation when the chips were down. There's a new leader in Baghdad now, and one thing that people will be watching with great interest in the coming weeks is whether that new Shia leader will be able to mend some of those fences in the western provinces of Iraq and bring the Sunnis back on side to save Iraq, to save Iraq's future as a unitary state.
Thanks, Jack. Kesser in Germantown. Hi.
Hi. I'm going to speak with a little bit of passion because I am a victim of these animals. Whether they're Al-Qaeda or Taliban or ISIS, they're butchers and they're animals. 12th of May this year, they killed my older brother, who was a very good humanitarian doctor. Oh. On 19th of March, they killed my cousin, who was a wonderful doctor and a wonderful man and a great father, just because they were doctors, educated, and we are minority. Now, we tend to choose the wrong people, whether we were fighting. We nurture these people, and they come back to haunt us. It has been U.S. foreign policy. We can go back, you know, in regards to the Taliban. We supported them. Bin Laden, we supported him. We gave him millions and billions of dollars, and he came back to haunt us. We need to choose our friends wisely. We send these experts who sit in a hotel, look out the window, come back and tell us this is who we need to support. You should be, the U.S. foreign policy should be talking to people like me or the or people who come from these parts of the world. Our worst enemy, unfortunately, is not Iran or non-Hezbollah and not Hamas. It is the Saudi government. The 99% of the problems that we are having in the Muslim world are because of the Saudi support to these fundamentalists. We eventually will beg Iran to help us take down ISIS, because Iran is the only power, and we have alienated Iran over and over and over. We need to restudy our foreign policy. We need to get rid of all of these people who have been working in this State Department and bring in people who know exactly how to deal with these people. ISIS, Taliban, Al-Qaeda are animals. They're butchers. They put 7 bullets in my brother, who was a wonderful doctor. Mm-hmm. They put 6 bullets in my brother, and unfortunately, we have the pictures of these guys, because they were killed in a hospital that my family owned. We can't find them because they have gone back into the mountains of Afghanistan.
Ray, a response to that.
Well, look, I mean, the caller is absolutely right that there are forces that continue to get support and continue to get cash from around the world. But certainly Saudi Arabia has been a big source of funding. For people who are putting forward a kind of cult of death in response to the failures of government, if you look back to the 1940s and 1950s, in the immediate era after the smoke began to clear from the Second World War, there was a rise of secular leaders in not only Asia, but in Africa, in Latin America. They wanted to move countries away from their traditional religious orientation. So Nehru, while he was a Hindu, was not a Hindu nationalist. Sukarno, while a Muslim, wanted to de-emphasize Islam in Indonesian life. Nasser was a secularist and a pan-Arabist, not an Islamist. But all those countries failed. They failed. The independence leaders across North Africa who pulled Algeria and Tunisia out of French orbit, they promised their people something else, and it failed. And by creating authoritarian states in a lot of these places, they made the mosque into the petri dish from which a radical opposition grows. They made it the only place where your mind could be free. And even those places were probably under surveillance from secret police. So there's nothing inherent to Islam that would have made these places the sources of violent, nihilistic, murderous opposition. It just happened to happen that way because of the failure of the state, the failure of the promise of secular government, and the failure of modernity to make people rich, secure, educated, and with a belief in the future. Look, it's country after country after country. Saddam was not an Islamist. Nasser was not an Islamist. The older Assad, the father of the current dictator, was not one. They wanted something different for their people, and they ended up giving us exactly the opposite because of the mess they made of governing those places.
He makes a couple of points I want to follow up on. Kesser, thank you very much for your call. He brings up Iran and the importance of Iran in trying to figure out a solution here. Would you agree, Ray?
Well, Iran is the leader of the Shia people, both in a religious and a political and in an aspirational way. They're not Arabs, and that's important to remember. Iran is not an Arab state, but has friends throughout the Arab world because of the influence of Shia Islam. And that has to be understood and recognized in the United States. It hasn't been as well understood as it should be in recent years. And oddly, many people in the United States worry about the rise of Iranian influence, but the United States just spent the last 14 years ridding Iran of two pesky, destabilizing, and dangerous neighbors, Taliban-led Afghanistan and Saddam-led Iraq. I mean, that was like sending a gift to the regime in Tehran. What did we think was going to happen? Mm. Iran has been ascendant, and we've taken care of some of their most pressing near geographical threats and problems. Mm-hmm. Of course they're ascendant. They are one country that hasn't had a war in that region, not in recent years. And for all their internal political problems, the leadership there is able to play on the constant opposition to Iranian drives for self-respect and the respect of the surrounding region that seem to be rebuffed at every turn. This is a proud people who feels that it's not taken seriously by the other powers in the world. And if you keep rubbing their noses in it, they're only going to be harder to deal with and more recalcitrant.
And the other, you could hear the emotion in his voice calling his brothers killed by what he called these barbarian forces. It would appear to me that if you knew this, that Kesser should be sitting down with somebody because he has horrible firsthand of knowledge of who these groups are. It was remarkable to me that he really didn't, he hasn't been approached by anybody to say, what do you think? He's been victimized by this.
Well, people from Pakistan and Afghanistan who are part of the educated elite in those countries have been desperately trying to play a role in the reconstruction of these societies and have had, I think, to their own dismay, very little impact on the future trajectory of the country. Pakistan is really a little hard to figure out. The almost aggressively self-destructive nature of Pakistani society. This is a country that parted ways with India at independence from the British Empire and has underperformed and underserved its people in every decade since, in a really disastrous kind of way. And because of that, has been vulnerable to the contagion of religious-based extremism. It's the only solace that's available to a people that's without hope, is to go on Friday and listen to an imam tell you that actually you've been cheated by your own leaders, and the thing to do is to blow them up.
We welcome more phone calls. Ray Suarez is our guest this hour. We are talking about, well, you can't just talk about one thing. It has to be other things as well. We are looking at the news this week that the United States is gathering, well, has reconnaissance missions over Syria right now to try and gather intelligence on ISIS. As the president contemplates, maybe not tomorrow, but perhaps sometime in September, airstrikes against ISIS in Syria, which raises a whole host of problems. How do you have airstrikes against ISIS in Syria when you are totally opposed to the regime that's in Syria? What's your ultimate goal? How do you get the American people behind you? We can't look at this without looking at the history of what has happened with us in Iraq and what's happened to that country over the last 10 years. And we're also looking at Middle Eastern response to try to stop the growth of ISIS. We're figuring out who these people are. And those are just a few of our many items that we're discussing this hour. We have phone lines open right now if you've been trying to get through. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you can't get through, our email is talk@wpr.org. Ray Suarez is the host of Inside Story. It airs weekdays at 4 o'clock Central Time on Al Jazeera America, the cable news channel that covers domestic and international news. He, of course, was with PBS NewsHour for a number of years and also hosted NPR's Talk of the Nation for many years. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ray Suarez this hour. Let's go to Catherine in Three Lakes next. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Hi.
I can't hear you.
I can hear you, Catherine. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. This is such a fascinating, complex issue. I'm delighted by this program. I wanted to raise the issue again of Saudi Arabia. There was an op-ed piece in the New York Times just recently that was really highly critical, to put it mildly, of the Saudi government for exporting its brand of Salafism, the very fundamentalist, repressive type of Islam. And the author of that op-ed thought that that the Saudis, in a sense, were behind ISIS and a lot of the other very radical groups in the Middle East. So I wonder what Ray Suarez has to say about that.
You know, a lot of the extremism that we see exported and that blame laid at Saudi Arabia's door actually happens because that's the Saudi way of keeping it at bay and keeping it from destabilizing the Saudi state. At the very earliest founding of the state after the First World War, deals were cut with religious elements inside what was to become Saudi Arabia. And that more austere, tougher version of Islam was allowed an ascendancy in return for an acquiescence to the Saud family taking control of the state. And they've managed that very delicate balance in the years since. A tremendous amount of money is sent out of the country to employ imams, to build and run mosques, to print religious texts, which are distributed throughout their sphere of influence. And, you know, it's a problem that I think a lot of the rest of the world hasn't fully taken into account. We're aware of it intellectually, but it's hard to fully measure just how much of an impact that's had and just how, in certain states that don't have strong institutions, strong government, strong belief in the rule of law, courts, effective national education systems, how that kind of religious colonization, you might say, ends up having a big, big influence in what kind of country you end up running.
Thank you, Catherine. I can't remember where this came from. I take my notes, and they're from so many sources. But somebody was making the point when looking at the makeup of ISIS that the head of the ISIS media department The media department is heavily Saudi. The chief spokesperson for Baghdadi is Syrian. One group of foreign fighters is led by an ethnic Chechen. So people are coming from various places. But interesting that the PR department is coming are Saudi Arabians.
A lot of the people who get identified as Saudis inside these groups would be in jail if they were back home.
Interesting.
So they're free and at large doing what they do because they're not home.
Let's go to Gary in Duluth next. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, I have two questions. Just wondered if you had any thoughts on the three-state solution. And the other thing is the connection. I believe the Islam religion is rather paternalistic in nature. And I believe there's a connection between paternalism and aggressiveness, because aggressiveness is seen as a positive masculine trait to have.
Ray.
Well, the three-state solution, which Joe Biden got roundly criticized for and even sometimes mocked for, is starting to look to some people a lot better right now. But, you know, it may be a three-state solution in reality but not in name, a de facto three-state solution without being a de jure one, where there's high degrees of autonomy in the western Sunni heartland of Iraq, in the northern Kurdish autonomous region, and in the more Tehran aligned Shia heartland to the east. Obviously, it's not going to be a neat division. There are multiple groups on all sides of these theoretical lines. But, you know, if you had gone that way with a very loose confederation where the three main elements of the society would have been able to make their own rules, there are some people, many in Washington, who would have said, look, that's the way to go. Forcing these people to live with each other and have their lives run from Baghdad is not going to work. As far as paternalism, I don't know. Christianity is a pretty heavily paternalistic religion, too, and we wouldn't necessarily ascribe to Christianity some of the things that are being hung around the neck of Islam in these latest days. I always get a little uncomfortable trying to analyze religion in those terms, because there are over a billion Muslims, and for many of them, the kinds of things that are being done in the name of Islam today would be totally unimaginable, totally anathema. They're your neighbors, they're your friends. The oldest mosque in the United States is in Iowa, and the people who go to that mosque were born in 30 different countries, and many of them think of themselves as just as American as anybody else. And so they look at what's happening in those other parts of the world with the same horror that other Americans do. Yeah. So I get a little uncomfortable when trying to analyze a religion in that way.
Dave, we're almost out of time, but go ahead with your comment at least. Dave from Wisconsin Rapids.
Thank you, Kathleen, and thank you, Mr. Suarez. Shortly after 9/11, just about 13 years ago, within a couple of weeks after that show, after that terrible day, Kathleen, your show had to do, the question was, how should we respond to this attack? And I was able to call, and I suggested that we had the goodwill and the sympathy of most of the world, including the Islamic world, on our side at the time, and that we should follow the rule of law and go after these people as criminals, which they were. And obviously we didn't do that. And now 13 years later, and how many, God knows how many thousand lives and billions of dollars of our treasure, and we've made more enemies than we started with.
And on that note, we have to end our program. We have to look at the history, of course, as well, which is a big part of this. Ray Suarez, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thanks so much for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. Ray Suarez, our guest this hour, and we thank him for being with us. He is on Al Jazeera now, and his show is on at 4 o'clock on Central Time. Central Time, it's on 4 o'clock. So thank you to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour, and to KP Whaley and Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production. Thanks for all of your calls and for listening.